didn't make it easy, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here we go. Where we left off.
Always.
Okay. So.
Nothing.
That was mild, huh?
So, usually we have, you know, the whole structure of the cognitive therapy. Blah, woo, usually the structure of the session is, they're tools to help, they make things more efficient and help to, change things. But it turns out that with histrionic personality disorder, the structure of the cognitive therapy, actually, it can be very therapeutic in and of itself. So let's just say the agenda, okay? Normally, agenda's really just, it's just plain old helpful in making sure that you cover the important things, you're being clearly collaborative, and nothing gets left to the last 3 minutes. But with the whole concept of thinking in advance about what you want to do for the next hour and actually doing it is a very foreign concept to a person with histrionic personality disorder. So just that tool, that's just a tool to structure the session, but with these people, it can be very challenging. But boy, when they can stop and think and decide, make a choice, and then follow through on it, that's very therapeutic. They've already made headway. And each piece of the structure is actually begins moving them towards a place where they're more likely to be able to reach their goals. So you will need, and you might as well, and I'm hoping in the role play, you will practice interrupting. There's no way. If you feel like you cannot, we all have types that we like and are good with and not so good with. If you can't interrupt and in a polite way, well, I start out polite. After that, it's like, what? You know what I mean? Because they're with the program. But if you feel like you can't interrupt the person and structure the session, there's no shame in that. Just you should not be seeing these patients, and and they should be seeing someone who can. We're not all good with all kinds of people, and there's nothing wrong with that. So, now one thing you can do is we are open to compromise, and often that's necessary with this type of person. They want to vent. They would love to spend the entire session venting about life, but then they'll be annoyed that they're not getting anywhere or accomplishing anything. So you can compromise. And if it's really hard for them, if the idea of sticking to an agenda is just seems, they feel like you don't care and, but it's so important for me to tell you these things, compromise. Set up the session and say, okay, tell you what. I know that to achieve your goals, we have to work in a systematic manner, review the homework and look at what you're going to do next week and really work towards these goals. But you really feel the need to vent in an unstructured manner. So how about if we save the last 10 minutes of the session, and that will be your vent time, okay? Now please, and put that on the agenda, so we're going to talk about your homework and about this terrible fight you had with your husband, and then last 10 minutes, unstructured venting times. Now, always put that at the end of the session. If you put it at the beginning, they're going to get all wrapped up, and it's going to be very, very difficult to stop and get anything else done. If you agree to that on the agenda, then be sure you do it. Don't just get caught up in doing the work of the session and skip their vent time. That's a violation of the agreement. It's not collaborative. Stop the session and say, okay, now it's time for you to feel free to tell me whatever you like about the week. And can you guess what ends up happening?
She doesn't want to do it.
What?
She doesn't
want to
do it.
What happens is, for the first time or two, they're like, okay, good, good, good. And by the way, I don't know how your offices are set up, but I, because you can have the same problem at the end of the session, that they don't want to stop, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I get up and leave. So, oh, no. Oh, I absolutely do.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the end of the session. I mean, I'm like, well, see, my clients get to know me very well. And I go to the bathroom between every session, okay? And it's like, okay, now we're going to need to stop, but, sorry. I mean, I'm very strict. Seriously, they learn in very quickly. You don't mess, and you don't get between me and the bathroom. Okay, our secretary, lovely, every new secretary we've had to train. You don't use the bathroom between 10 till and the hour, or especially not 5 till and the hour, because we only have often 3 minutes to pee. So you got the whole other time. You don't use my time. So I'll joke about it, but it's like, as you know, I'm going to have to go before my next person, and yes, I do acknowledge to them, I have other patients. They're not the only one. I know, it's kind of hard for them to take. But I do end, giving myself enough time to have a little break. And I will. Everything's all secured, and I just say, okay, well, I'll let you wrap up and pay the secretary. I'll see you in 2 weeks. And they learn really quickly if you're very clear with your limits. But if you give them that time, they'll do it for a time or two. But then they'll see, it doesn't take long for them to see the results they get in using cognitive behavior therapy towards their goals. And so they'll be just getting it, they'll be getting into the work of the session. And you say, okay, now it's time for you to have your unstructured time. And they will say, that's okay. I'd rather finish up what we were doing because I think we really hit on something here. And then as long as if they agree to it and you agree to it, it's okay. But before you leave it off the agenda, I mean, then you ask them now, do you want that unstructured cement time? And really, I don't think I've ever had anyone who's kept up with an unstructured venting time through the whole therapy. I mean, it just doesn't happen because they realize it doesn't get them anywhere. But that's different from you telling them, we're not going to do that. If it's important to them, give them a chance. Similarly, they haven't paid attention to their own thoughts and feelings. So asking them to monitor, pinpoint their thoughts, I mean, it's very important to developing a sense of identity and really making changes in their thoughts and feelings. But do not expect. And sometimes I think certainly in the tapes I get, people kind of want to cram in a whole bunch of interventions to show that they can do a bunch of interventions. These are not people who you can just say, well, here's the thought sheet, first column is the situation, and then there's your feelings, and then there's your thoughts, so keep track this week. Absolutely not! These people are, they're going to have no clue. So you really have to take time to explain what you want, do clear written examples in the session, and change your expectations. So on page 18, you can't get the sense of a early histrionic thought sheet. And by the way, the marital therapist tried to get the couple to do thought sheets. He told me when I started, he said, you will never get Cindy to do thought sheets. She's incapable of doing thought sheets. He also was convinced that she was really stupid. And she was very global and impressionistic. She's not a stupid woman. She just didn't think things through. So it doesn't really convey. But what the person tends to do in early thought sheets, if they're histrionic, they write across all the columns, just ignoring the columns. They just fill up the page. And they've been, so she, you know, it doesn't really convey in a typed form, but, you know, it was 4 a.m., and Joe and I met on the stairs, and I was putting a note on his desk, and he bobbed up, and he wrinkled it, and he said, I'm not going to put up with your crap. If you want to fight, if you want to go to heaven, go to hell. You know, so they just write out, they spend huge amounts of time on the situation, and then, you know, not too much on the other stuff, and it's all over the place. Often, it's in, you know, multicolored and with all kinds of, you know, diagrams and smiley faces and things. But, hey, it all gets credit. Great, you tried. Don't expect much. You might not even be able to do a three column in the beginning. You might just have them write a situation and try to write it briefly and list a feeling. Or, you know, or maybe one thought. And don't expect, because this is huge for them. They don't listen to themselves. They don't pay attention. It's very foreign. But it wasn't that much longer that Cindy could do a reasonable thought sheet. Now, it's still dramatic, okay? So Cookie calls her brother, which was her husband. So it's her sister-in-law calls her husband to give him back a gun. She says she's going to meet us at the parking lot with a gun. And then, you know, I hate guns. Why is she ruining our evening? Why is she doing this? She wants to kill me. And then she was able to look at it like, that's stupid. She's not threatened to kill. She's returning something she borrowed. You know, she's not threatening to kill me. So she was able to learn to do it relatively quickly with a lot of patient structure and with a clear image of why she should. Don't just ask people to do stuff. They have to see, and I'll tell them, look, you have been so caught up in your own feelings, I won't, you know, and focusing on how other people are reacting, that you haven't paid attention to your own thoughts and feelings. And this is not easy. I get that. But it's hard to change how you're thinking and feeling if we don't pay attention to it. So you want to show them how this is going to be related to their goals. Why should they do a thought sheet? Now, she journaled. She was a dancer. She was very artistic. And she loved journaling. She had probably a library full of journals over the years. Similarly, be flexible. Person can, if they feel like they want to do journaling, have them say, do fine. Journal, write all about your week, but do a structured thought sheet in addition, okay? And by the way, and I know somebody who learned the hard way that they made this mistake, do not promise to read their journal every session, okay? We don't get paid that much. I mean, and you're not going to want to take session time. You can bring in your journal, and if there's one little segment that you think is important for me to review, mark that, and we'll put it on the agenda. But do not agree to take it home and read it. You don't get paid enough. You end up really resenting these people because they'll quiz you on their journal. Well, you know what happened Tuesday night? It's like, no, but bring it in, and I'm glad to look at one little excerpt. Yes.
I have a question about the thought sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So after, first few weeks is okay, then as things kind of stabilize, client feeling better and thing, I notice there's a problem. Client has a hard time filling out thought sheet. What they usually say, well, there's nothing really happened. Things are much more calmer, so I didn't have much to write.
Well, be very careful. If you're saying after a few weeks, be very careful. True change takes time. So if the person comes in, say, with anxiety, and if they're saying, well, nothing happened for me to, there was nothing to deal with, well, then maybe we have to up the ante. Maybe we need to have you being exposed to things that are more difficult. Or is it possible that you haven't been in the situations that get those feelings? People, understandably, they get lazy. It's very hard to master, to really change your thoughts and your feelings and your assumptions and beliefs in a few sessions. So I'm very skeptical when people say, well, you know, I don't need to do that anymore. And if they say, and remember I talked about the course of therapy, at the end of the first term. If they say, well, I'm doing it, I'm just doing it in my head, it's like, great. So give me, and then I'm going to take time in the session. So let's look at a situation. What did you actually do in your head? And if they've truly accomplished their goal, which takes a while, and I don't just give up lightly, then you need to be looking at, are there other goals, or how are they going to maintain that accomplishment? But even when people have achieved, and are doing really well with their goal, I'll say, well, you know, you don't need to do a thought sheet every day. But I like to have people, if that's a technique we're using and it's relevant for their goal, I like to have them looking at their thoughts and feelings, doing a thought sheet once a week to keep their finger in so they'll have the technique when they need it. If they just stop, it's so easy to just run with your thoughts and feelings and not be paying attention. So, and certainly these guys, you're not going to get them doing anything in a few weeks. And honestly, the same thing happens with the unstructured journals. They'll bring their journal in, you know, a couple times, and then they'll just focus on doing what's relevant to their goals. So, but you got to give them a little leeway. And you need to constantly be bringing them back to, now, but why did we ask you to do this? Why are you doing this homework? Why are we working on this? Now you also, one thing that's unique to this part, I don't know, probably not unique, but especially important to pay attention, is that a direct challenge of their automatic thoughts may not be sufficient, since histrionic patients are often very good at using emotional outbursts to manipulate the situation. Okay? So, example. When her husband would come home late from work, Cindy would have a huge temper tantrum, and she'd have thoughts like, how can he do this to me? He doesn't love me anymore. I'll die if he leaves me. Okay? And then she'd throw a big fit. They'd have a major fight, chasing, punching, 911, you name it. But at the end, they would end up making up, and he would get all upset, about what happened. And, different people don't like to admit this, but often people have they have secret love tests, and she felt like, if she could get him to cry, that meant he really loved her. So, all this hoopla, but then she'd end up getting reassurance that she was loved, because he would be upset, he would lose it. So, if we did a direct, it wouldn't hurt to direct challenge. Okay, so she has the automatic thought, how can he do this to me, he doesn't love me. Well, what's he actually doing to you? We can look at that, and actually, what are some possibilities? Do you think he could be doing this to punish you, or he could have gotten stuck in traffic, or he could have forgotten to call because he's busy? We could look at we could challenge it, and we could look at, well, will you really die if he leaves you, and how did you do before? So we can do a direct challenge. But the truth is, by getting upset, she got reassurance. She accomplished something. She manipulated the situation. So, in addition to challenging the thoughts directly, what I often want to do with these people, and I'll put this on the top of the fact sheet, is stop and ask themselves, okay, what do I really want now? What would actually make me feel better? What am I really looking for? And usually, I have found with these people, because if you look at the diagram, they're so concerned about being taken care of and being rejected, that often behind the hoopla, the temper tantrum, what they really want is reassurance. Okay? They really want some, they feel like, so when he came home late, that felt like he didn't care. And she really wanted reassurance that he cared. Well, to be honest, by the time I'm in the picture, he wasn't so sure he cared. And she wasn't so sure he cared, that she cared. Things were bad. But when you start, if you ask the person, I'll write it across, what do you really want now? What are you actually looking for? And they can actually learn, with your help, to find, and then you can problem solve. Okay, so you do end up with him telling you that he loves you. Or this is directly, your Nazarene, your patient, you know. She would get all jealous and huffy, but she said, then he'd feel bad, and he'd apologize, and he'd pay attention to me. It worked, right? It worked. So, okay, so if you know in advance that that's what you want, you feel the need for reassurance, that's one way to get it. And I always, by the way, always acknowledge the sick way. Always say, you can do that. You can do that. That gets you your reassurance. Are there other ways to get that reassurance? You know, could you ask for it assertively? Could you, I mean, do something? I'm even willing to acknowledge, I mean, to accept doing something that's maybe not all that great or that healthy, but it's better than what they've been doing. So, better to yell than to punch a hole in the wall, you know. So, very important to recognize that it's important for them to look at what, you know, what they get out of their behavior. And are there other ways that you could, that they could go about getting something similar? Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on impulse control because Jim's going to talk a bunch about that next time with borderline personality disorder, but they clearly have a lot of problems with impulses and just the idea of stopping and thinking about what you're going to say before you actually say it. Again, very foreign, challenging, but they can be taught and they can learn if it's important to them. What I do want to talk about that I don't see written a lot about is the identity disorder piece. Once you really, and they don't come in with this, they, you know, but as you start working and achieve some of their goals and they're starting to look a little more inside, they start to realize that they don't really know what's in there. And that's a scary thing. Because they actually often have this all caps neon lights vision of identity. It's like they look around and everyone else knows who they are and has a core sense of self. And they don't. And it's very frightening. Now, I don't believe that they don't have identity. I don't, I mean, they just have never paid attention. So, but a lot, one of the characteristics of histrionic personality disorder is that they're very gullible. They're so busy looking at other people, and they can get, you know, talked into all kinds of things. And they change with the people who they're with, so then they don't feel like, you know, there's anything solid or stable. So when you get to the point where they start to realize and say, but I don't know who I am, or I don't know what's in there. You know, if I'm, you know, so Cindy, she'd talk to a friend and she'd get all pumped, okay, I'm going to leave my husband. But, oh, she'd talk to her mother and get all pumped, I'm going to leave my husband. But then she'd talk to a friend and it's like, well, you know, things aren't all that bad, I better say. You know, she's just totally all over the place and affected by other people. And so you've already done, by the time this comes up, you've already done a bunch of work because you've been setting agendas, you've been sending homework, you've been following up on the homework, they've been looking at thoughts and feelings. So, when it comes up, one thing is to demystify the word identity or sense of self or whatever they use as their terminology. They have this notion that it's this thing inside that they're lacking. And what I will do, and I always keep a regular old dictionary on my shelf so I can do this dramatically, okay? So I'll pull out the dictionary and I'll turn it to the word identity and I'll read the description. And most dictionaries talk about, you know, your identity is the sense of your own values, beliefs, opinions. A lasting sense of your values, beliefs, and opinions. I start with, and this is one of those homework assignments that goes on over the course of multiple sessions and is often a keeper. I'll demystify. I'll say, you know, it feels like you don't know who you are. But you've expressed a whole number of things already to me in therapy, you know. So let's pull out a sheet of paper and look at what you know about your values, beliefs, opinions, okay? And so I'll often have them pull out, you know, I get a new notebook, a nice notebook, or, you know, but it can be done on any piece of tablet of paper. And I'll start in the session, don't send them home cold to do this. Just look at, okay, what do we know about your preferences, your values, beliefs, opinions, anything? So what's a color that you like? Not your favorite color, that might be too hard. You know, pick one, you know, I'm picking one. But what, you know, I see that you're wearing purple. Do you like purple? Great, let's put that on. I like the color purple. I'm very serious. If you, I'll list all kinds of very mundane things. I can't stand, I like sushi, but I can't stand octopus. I'm speaking for myself. Okay. Other kinds of sushi, fine, but octopus or squid, come on, too chewy. Okay, put that down. Just look at all kinds of mundane, you know, what style of clothing, what do you watch on TV, you know, look at what kinds of things the person, and what do you already know about that person? And so when Cindy would come in, you know, and she's like furious with her daughter, and she'd say, you know, she lied to me, and I hate it when people lie to me. I'm like, oop, let's put that down. You hate it when people lie to you? That's a strong belief. It demystifies the whole thing. It gets them paying attention. Well, how do I feel? And, you know, and then start to question, you know, I bought this dress because my husband liked it, but actually, I really prefer a long skirt with a top. And I don't, you know, I mean, then it gets them starting to think, okay, what do I feel as opposed to other people? Now, you often have to back it up and ask, is it okay to have your own values, beliefs, and opinions? Remember, these people are trying to get your attention and trying to please you, other people. One thing you have to discuss early on when you're dealing with identity is another concept that's foreign to them. You can have a strong belief or opinion or value and not express it. I grew up in the 60s. It was the thing to just express everything. Bad idea. Nobody wants to hear everything. I mean, there's a time and a place for expression, I'll tell you. I mean, if I get pulled over by a policeman because I've been speeding, he doesn't need to know how I've been feeling all day, you know, or how I feel about being pulled over. So they do worry about, well, if I pay attention, then I'm going to have to express it, and people, somebody who doesn't feel that way isn't going to like it. And you could talk about, you can feel really strongly and not say a word and not let anybody know about it. You don't even have to tell me. Very important, because if it means you're going to get rejected, they're not going to pay attention. But you can have feelings, and then you can experiment with, well, who can I express things to, and who can I not, and what kinds of things? I mean, you know, I sure have lots of family members where, of course, especially nowadays, I don't want to talk politics. I want to be able to eat dinner. I don't want to get nauseous. I know people where I'm just not going to discuss this kind of thing. And over here, you know, differentiating. Oh, it's not all black and white. Well, wait, your best friend, you can talk about anything. Great. Maybe with your husband, maybe there are certain things that don't work so well. Maybe you talk about different things. I mean, I know people who talk about their sex lives with their teenage children. Mm-hmm. It's like, and this poor girl, oh my goodness, growing up in this household was not a pretty thing for anything. Mm-hmm. But then you can gradually test it out in small steps in the real world. But the important thing is, she can begin, there's nothing like writing a list of like 300, not usually 300, or 37, 52 different things, mundane, boring, stupid things, to get the person realizing, well, I do know a lot about myself. I do have an identity. It's just nothing terribly dramatic, and it never is. So, but it's an important thing to address, because if you don't even ask about it, if it doesn't come up, they could be sitting there, you know, really scared that other people are going to find out that there's nothing there. And see, they do come across as really shallow because they haven't been paying attention, and they'll go whichever way the wind blows. So, even paying attention to what their preferences are makes them just that little bit less shallow. And so, an important thing that isn't necessary in treating a whole bunch of other people. And so then you get to the piece. And by the way, what I do with those diagrams, when I'm treating a complicated patient, especially with personality disorders, I'll look at those diagrams and I'll ask myself, am I hitting, first of all, how much of this is relevant to my patient? These are general diagrams. I mean, you want a conceptualization of your own patient. But I'll look at our general diagram and ask myself, wait a second, am I missing? Have I even touched on this piece? And could this be important? And it keeps me focused on, wait a second, I wonder if I'm missing this whole thing, and at least look at it. Yes.
So would that be the same thing, for self-esteem and self-confidence?
You know,
because it seems the same thing.
So, I don't think so.
You know,
so.
Like to talk about what their identity, what they know about themselves and stuff like that.
Well, see, self, I consider, and I've said this before, and by the way, people, this is another one of the things that people, I say a million times and nobody listens. I do take it personally, you know. I'm a person. self-esteem can mean so many different things to so many different people that it's not a really helpful goal. But if you're talking about, say, feeling good about yourself, that's a specific. See, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about paying attention to your values and beliefs and opinions, whatever they are. I think that's very different from feeling good about yourself. I'm all for feeling good about yourself and being assertive and confident and behaving. But it's different. It's just, it's understanding yourself.
Yeah.
It's paying attention. It's valuing. Here's what's important with the histrionic person. It's valuing what goes on inside. Giving it the importance to pay attention to, which they haven't. they've been so focused on everybody else. What, and they will even, you'll find them quoting their husband or their mother or whatever, and saying, but you know what, I'm asking what you think. Whoa, what do you mean? See the difference? It's mm-hmm. like, you can feel bad about yourself but have a strong sense of identity, or you can feel great about yourself and have no sense of identity.
The problem is that there's nothing there for them.
They don't see anything, not even
positive or negative.
Right. They just don't see it because it's all in context. See, everything's in context. So if they're home alone, you know, so who are you when you get home? You know, people would ask that. You know, it's like, and in fact, I validate, by the way, there's nothing wrong with being somewhat different and different. I mean, I'm different when I'm teaching than when I'm with a patient. I'm different with my friends. You know, I mean, you know, we're all somewhat different in different contexts. But if we don't have a choice about it, you know, if we feel like we always have to be judging the crowd and, oh, he frowned. He may have frowned because, my God, it's the end of the day and it's a Saturday and I'd really rather be home. You know, it's kind of nice out even, you know.
But you're more enmeshed.
Huh?
Enmeshed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's everyone. That's what's so, it's everyone is important because if everybody else in the room thinks it's great and they're smiling, but he's frowning, that reminds me someone might reject me. So he's more important with his frown than everybody else. And so it's a problem. Now with the self-sufficiency and the problem solving, these are things that need to be taught. Okay, how do you solve a problem? And we're going to keep talking. We talked a little bit with generalized anxiety disorder about how instead of worrying, can you do active problem solving? You know, it's something people are not taught. Define the problem, list a whole bunch of alternatives, think it through, what are the consequences of each. I'm not going to teach someone how to balance their checkbook or how to drive better. You know, I might drive with somebody who's just can drive but is anxious about it, but I can help them find somebody who can help them with that. You know, and I certainly can help them figure rather than just going, oh my God, I can't do this. Well, let's look at what would it take to figure out how to do this or learn how to do this. So, and then there are the relationships. Now, usually when you deal with personality disorders, you are going to be dealing with their relationships are going to be problematic, and they're going to bring that into the relationship with you. And this is one thing that happens with, again, with the previous therapist. He was kind of not invested because he did felt like the marital therapy was not going to work, and he found her very annoying. So he kind of bailed. She kind of bailed, so she wouldn't show up, you know, she'd be late, you know, that's also very typical. Oh, I have to talk to you, but I couldn't help it, I'm 45 minutes late, and it's like, but I'm sure you'll make time for me. It's like, no, I will not. Limits, very important. But it's interesting because I was more invested in the treatment, and I'm tough with limit. The first time Cindy no-showed, and she did, you know, I'm like, you know, as you know, you signed the policy statement, we do charge for no-shows, but, no, I mean, I was here, I saved that time for you, you know, you owe me for the session. And, you know, they can get angry, and they can stomp off, and I am very important with personality disorders. Be willing to say goodbye if that's what it takes. Mm-hmm. Set the limits. If they know you're not going to follow through, it's just like a two-year-old. Then they're going to do the same thing over and over. It's like, you know, I hope you won't make that choice. I mean, I think we're doing some good work here, but I have the same policy for everyone, and I really can't afford to, you know, that hour was a time when another patient would have wanted to be here. So, you know, you're going to need to pay before we continue. And she never no-showed again. And she did a lot of wait and no-shows. And I also, I am pretty compulsive about, I end on time. So to be honest, I really do need to hit the bathroom. But even if I didn't, I would end on time because I just think it gives a message that my limits are, you know, bad. And I don't, you know, I'm not their friend. I'm here, I'm running a business. So, and looking at relationships, you know, sometimes it comes down to they've done this attention-seeking thing for so long, and sooner or later you need to help them look at the advantages and disadvantages of doing whatever it is that they're doing, whether it's being seductive or, and honestly, they get a lot out of attention, and they're scared. They do become, later in the treatment, they get, and this is also true for a lot of the personality disorders, they look at us, and we're actually, we like to think we're great role models, because of course we're all terribly well-adjusted and successful and perfect in every way. What we need to pay attention to and realize is that for many patients, we are frightened, we're scary. They're afraid that they're going to end up like us. Okay? No, a histrionic patient is really terrified by the idea that if they stick with the cognitive approach, if they stick with me, they're going to end up rational and boring. Terribly frightening idea. Seriously, I mean, they have gotten so much reward for being exciting and fun and exuberant, that, you know, the idea of coming drab and dull like me is scary. So you need to, you really need to, you know, address that the second you notice it, or even if you don't. They have, believe me, I will say this directly to them. It's like, look, we're talking about we're not changing who you are. And we don't need to change who you are. And actually, we're just trying to reach these goals and have it be less extreme so that you can live the kind of life you want. So use their drama. That's why I get a little dramatic in the sessions with them. You know, and I'll say, I'm going to be terribly rude. And pause and wait for them to go, oh, not you. Yes, you know. You can do all kinds of things. You can really encourage them to be dramatic when they write their rational responses. I don't need boring thought sheets. I want real thought sheets. So I had one patient who wrote an automatic thought, and her response was, that's a pimply white lie, and you know it. You know, I'll encourage them to use colored inks and write smiley faces or frowny faces. I'll encourage, you know, if they're acting too, like, goody-goody, we want these powerful. What speaks to you? One thing they love, David Burns talks a lot about externalization of voices is the technique. And what it really is doing thought sheets out loud. Oh, they love it because it's like acting, right? It's like, okay, I'm going to be the automatic thought and you be the rational response. Okay? They love this. So, oh no, my husband's going to, I'll die if he leaves me. And I'll be, oh, I'll die if he leaves me. And they'll go, you will not die. You can live. You are a woman. You are strong. You know, we get dramatic. And they can do so. Or they play the automatic thought and you play the rational responses and then you switch. They can do this at home. They can do this in a mirror. They can talk to themselves and say, oh, I don't know, you better do, you know, if he doesn't like you, you'd better change so he'll like you. I'll be damned if I'm going to change so he'll like me. you know, if he can't, but in Maryland, I don't even know if it's true, but, you know, there's a meme. Oh, it was on the internet, so it must be true. Marilyn Monroe was said to have said, if you can't take me at my worst, you don't get me at my best. Okay, I like it. You know, hey, you know, I'm not going to change for you. I mean, I don't do me, whatever. They can answer in the mirror and really make those responses. You can encourage healthy drama all the way through the session. And really, you will need to do some of that, because the idea of, you know, they're terrified that you're going to turn them into an accountant. Believe me, there ain't no way. The most we can hope, the most we want, is to tone things down so they get what they want and they have a healthier life. They may need, really, legitimately, they may need to find other ways of getting drama in their life. They've been so used to the drama. And it's a legitimate thing to help them find an outlet. Now, the little agoraphobic who wanted to buy shoes, she found she got involved in one of these charismatic spiritual groups. I made sure she wasn't sending them vast quantities of money, because these people are very gullible. But it seemed relatively, you know, not too extreme of a group. But she got involved in, you know, people were speaking in tongues and things. It's like, okay, fine, you know. It wasn't, you know, I mean, if you want to be, you just, as long as it's not getting you into trouble, if you want to be a druid and go commune with tree, you know, I mean, whatever kind of, you know, a little different drama. One of the best things for these people is drama. Get into community theater. They usually love it. Not everyone. I mean, my histrionic businessman was not going to get into it. Although I actually think if he could, he probably would actually really love it. But he needed to find other outlets like sales, where he could be his dramatic self and be appreciated in a more healthy way. They could get involved in, you know, extreme sports. I don't care.
Dancing.
Dancing. Theater.
Yeah.
Music, you know, put on singing, you know. I mean, and so one woman... And it's funny because I see her, because she, it's amazing when you've been doing this as long as I have in the same community, because you run into people in different walks of life. She had been in a very abusive first marriage, and she got herself out, and she was now married to a very sweet, loving, nice guy, but she found the contrast, it was just not as dramatic. They didn't have drama in their relationship. So for her, so I talked about, you know, I mean, it's legit. You're used to some drama, which we need to find a healthy way to get that kind of rush that's not going to hurt you. And she came up with the idea of going back to grad school and becoming a social worker. Not my idea, but damn if she didn't do it, and it was challenging enough for her that it really got her pumping. And I run into her now, I mean, this was many years ago, I run into her at conferences and things, and it worked for her. So we can't judge what's going to be dramatic for them. But they do need to find some outlet, because if they don't, they really could, you know, find something that's not so healthy to get that drama. Sports, even spectator sports, you know, or do a blog nowadays. You know, I mean, anybody can be a star in their own blog, right? It doesn't matter if anybody actually listens to it. Now, another technique I'd be very careful about, don't do this willy-nilly, but for people who have trouble giving up the emotional trauma in their life and feel like they need to get terribly upset and depressed, it might make sense, be careful with it, but it might make sense to actually deliberately schedule a trauma. When by that I mean, and I wouldn't do this with someone who's suicidal or any risk whatsoever. But for someone who's had a history of, you know, dramatic, oh, I'm so depressed or whatever, I'll talk to them, okay, what's your image? Keeping within not doing anything destructive. So for me, I'll take myself. If I were going to schedule a depression, a dramatic depression, my image would be, it'd be in the middle of the day, I'd be home in my pajamas, in bed, eating bonbons. Now, I don't know what bonbons actually really are. Are those little ice cream things, or are they like jelly candy? I don't know. But it just was my image that you sit and wallow and cry and moan and eat bonbons. So that's my image of what, if I was going to schedule woe is me, okay? Talk to them about, okay, if you feel the need for an outlet, you know, it's kind of like the wallow time that we do with OCD or with worries, you know, schedule a time and go for broke. If you're sure that they're not going to do anything actually destructive and you define it for them, it's amazing how knowing they can be inappropriately extreme without getting into trouble, you know, just emote. And I didn't even realize this. But I found that I realized after the fact that I've been doing this with my friends back in college. So when I went to college, so you have to understand, when I went to college, I was extremely brilliant, as of course you know. But I had to earn my way through college. So I had the very challenging, not, job of, in the dining hall, I spent 10 hours a week separating the forks from the spoons and the knives. Okay? Now, for a brilliant, I mean, I'm 18. Who's more brilliant than an 18-year-old, right?
Yeah.
This was so beneath me, and my friends were doing the same thing. So what we didn't even think of it, and I didn't put it together until later what we were doing. So to pass the time while we're separating forks and spoons and knives, we'd have fake screaming fights over nonsense. I mean, we just express all our anger and frustration. It's like, you know, so my buddy Bob, he'd say, I saw you looking at that mailman. I know you have ideas. You're going to fool around. Oh, what are you talking about, you jealous pig? You know, and we'd scream because no one else was in the dining all the time. We'd scream and yell at each other. You know, and, you know, we didn't think anything of it. Well, we were actually venting in a harmless way that, you know, because we felt so abused by the fact of this incredibly boring job. You know, and so there's not, it's if you can do it carefully and the person relates, most people find that knowing they can wallow and vent, they'll do it a few times, and then they'll move on with life and not really do, it's not, but I've had very few patients, but a couple who've done it consistently once a month just to get it out of their system. You know, either a big depression or, again, if you're going to use anger, you want to make sure, because anger can escalate. If a person has anger control problems, you wouldn't do that. But because they can get themselves all worked up and, you know, and then, you know, actually go and express it somehow. But for like college students sorting silverware, we weren't going to lose control. We weren't going to go punch somebody. But boy, we had a lot of pent-up anger, and we got it out of our system in the dining hall. So you might, you know, it might work to schedule knowing that they can and they can emote in a safe, healthy, or non-destructive way. It frees them up to move on. And it is really, these people have often been rewarded for being very emotional and manipulative. So you as therapist, they will pull stuff on you. And you need to be sure to reward them when they're being assertive and competent, but not reward them. So, you know, when they're being overly emotional and manipulative. So that's why strict limits, and I do not encourage paging. You know, these are the kind of people who would want your attention and would page you all the time. I make it very clear. Boy, when you pay, I mean, if someone has a legitimate issue, you know, problem, they're suicidal or whatever, but it has to be an emergency, and I am very matter of fact. I'm not warm and cuddly if I get paged. It's like, okay, you know, if it's a genuine emergency, you need to go to the emergency room, you know. Or, you know, office, but, and so they don't, you know, if you set the clear limits, but with, you know, a lot of understanding and empathy. But you can't get caught up in rescuing them. And this is another danger with personality disorders in general. You will be tempted to violate your own professional standards because they will pull. These guys are good. They will pull. They will get you where you live. And you'll be with these people, I know for a fact that there are plenty of therapists in this community who have actually gotten into inappropriate sexual behavior with histrionic patients. These patients are come across as attractive, they're seductive. Don't go there. That's not what they need. And it's horrible for you. But they will, because that's how they've gotten their goodies. So they'll try. And you have to be very, very clear. That's not going to get them to their goals, and don't fall for sitting back and enjoying the entertainment and listening to their stories. And keep careful on those limits. If you're doing exposure with, you know, if they happen to be a panicker who's histrionic, and you're doing exposure, you make damn sure it doesn't look like a date to them or you or anybody. You're not friends. It is business. Business, business. And just, they're going to try to do what they do with everybody else with you. And that's, you know, understandable. And you can point that out. Okay, I noticed you're doing that in here. Do you do that out there with other people? And how's that work for you? And is that furthering your goals? But be very careful because they will, you know, they will suck you in, and we do not need that. So, now, I have a lot of follow-up with Cindy. There's not much, by the way, not much empirical literature. I'm talking about this is a field ripe for research, media attention. I mean, you can have, somebody needs to have fun with them, with this. Therapy's not quick. It's because every step you have to really retrain them. They don't become accountants, but they absolutely can become, might achieve their goals. And I have a lot of follow-up with Cindy because she actually achieved her therapy goals. And it took 44 sessions over the course of a year and a half. Not quick, not a 6 sessions, 5. And what she did is, the marriage, they tried another marital therapy. The marriage was already gone. It was time they split. The daughter, who'd been subject to this violent fight for her whole life, the daughter was 15 when she started. They got divorced. The daughter went 5 years without speaking to Cindy. Absolutely crushed the image. She was crushed, you know, her daughter. But I encouraged her to keep the door open, just remember birthday, don't push, but remember birthdays and Chris, you know, whatever, you know, send car, you know, just keep the door open, and damn if you, that, the daughter didn't eventually, when she became an adult, reestablish a relationship with Cindy, but it was rough. And the reason I have lots of follow-up is that Cindy actually, without scheduling or thinking about it, she would win for a very long time, tending to come in like once a year. Something, you know, I keep the door open, and she just, a new issue would come up. Like when she realized her daughter was not going to talk to her or have anything to do with her, she came in for a visit or two. Then, you know, another time she, you know, She had a crisis in a new relationship, or some different things came up. She knew I was a safe person to come to, but she really maintained her changes, and she's one of the few, and then I'm going to end, so we have a quick break. She actually ended up in a relationship with a histrionic male, but not as, she was not as histrionic, and he was never as histrionic, but he was an opera singer. And he was, but neither was so, at that point, was too extreme. So they actually made it work. So it's not impossible. It doesn't happen much. But they pulled it up. They made it work. And she actually contacted me not long ago to let me know, just in case I was expecting to hear from her in a year, that she was retiring to Florida and probably wouldn't be back in a year, but life was good. She had a good, her daughter had grown up and had great grandkids, and she had a relationship with the daughter, and life has gone on. So it's possible, but you want to really keep in mind the limits, and you don't want to violate and get too enmeshed, but you also do not want to slap them, which is also a temptation. I mean, it can be aggravating. And, you know, you need to use empathy to see where they're coming from. And was she still histrionic? Absolutely. Just not nearly as much. And it wasn't getting her in trouble. Mm-hmm. So.